With Joe Biden's victory in last Tuesday's election, a new administration takes charge in January, and they'll be facing some pretty big challenges. Along with COVID-19, climate change, and the battered economy, the unmasking and encouragement of racism and white supremacy over the past 4 years tops the list. Our in-depth guest today, Kenria Rankin, has been an important voice in that struggle as an author, journalist, editor, and speaker. Kenria co-authored How We Fight White Supremacy, a field guide to Black resistance, published last year. Her new book is Anti-Racism, Powerful Voices, Inspiring Ideas, available now from Seattle's Sasquatch Books. Kenria also co-hosts the Turn On podcast, which focuses on literary erotica created by and for Black women and the LGBTQ community. And she'll be moderating a panel at this year's Portland Book Festival. The session, titled No Justice, No Peace, takes place this Saturday, November 14th, and features young adult novelist Kim Johnson and Francisco X. Stork. Kenria, thanks for joining us today from your home in Washington, D.C.
Oh, thanks so much for having me on.
Kenria, let's get right to the newest book, Anti-Racism, Powerful Voices, Inspiring Ideas. It's a beautifully designed work. You've called it somewhat of a coffee table book, though a little smaller.
Yeah.
And it features over 100 quotes from anti-racist leaders, past and present. In the introduction, which really struck me, this analogy, a ladder analogy, you use to depict white supremacy, which you define as a political, social, and economic system that thrives on the subjugation of people who have not been let into whiteness. Can you describe that ladder for us?
Sure. So, as you said, I like to use that analogy because I think it really helps people to get an image of in their mind of what white supremacy is. So what I tell folks is to close your eyes and envision a ladder. It's sturdy, it's stable, it's firmly rooted into the ground. And on the very top rung sits white, cisgender, heterosexual, Christian, wealthy, educated, able-bodied man. And every other person in our society gets slotted in somewhere below him based on the oppression that's been heaped on their shoulders. And those oppressors can include racism, sexism, classism, homophobia, transphobia, ableism, all the isms and the obias that you can think of that push us closer down to the ground. And I like to use this because I think it can really help people understand the ways that the things that are heaped on us determine our place and our value within the society that we're operating in.
You also mentioned that there's a toxic smog, a very effective analogy, that envelops the ladder, and it affects everyone. So those white, Christian, middle-aged, able folks who are at the top of the ladder might think that it doesn't affect them. But you make a strong point that they're still being poisoned by the very same system that's hurting everyone else below those top rungs. How does white supremacy poison even those at the top of the ladder?
Well, I think that it doesn't take much more than to look at the celebrations that we had in the street over the weekend to see the ways that people have been pushing up against it and were happy to be freed from the ways that it impacts their lives, right? When you have someone who subscribes to white supremacy and who uses it in order to shore up their own power, the policies that they make influence the ways that we live, right? Even folks who are at the closer end of the top of that ladder can still feel negative effects when, policies are not put into place to keep them safe during a pandemic, for instance, right? There are folks who may check all of these boxes except for the fact that they are not wealthy, and they may vote for candidates who have policies that ultimately don't actually serve them, but because they led with their whiteness and because they wanted to prop up this system which has privileged them for so long, it can be easy to look past the ways that it hurts you economically in the long run, because it can be really attractive to see someone who feels the same ways that you do, who centers the issues that seem to be most important to you, even if they're not necessarily digging into the things that ultimately underpin the daily ongoings of your life, like not having stimulus checks that allow people to be able to stay home and stay safe in, you know, difficult times.
What struck me, and I liked a lot, was it's not just selfish and cruel, white supremacy, but it's also self-destructive for even those people at the top. Now, you include this quote from Angela Davis in the book. In a racist society, it's not enough to be non-racist. We must be anti-racist. And of course, the book is titled Anti-Racism and Not Non-Racism. Can you talk about the difference between the two?
Sure. So, you know, as I was saying earlier, that ladder that we're talking about of white supremacy, it's propped up by a few things. And those include, you know, racism and classism and whatnot. And so one thing I like to make clear is that white supremacy doesn't act on its own. It's got all these other things that prop it up, and racism is just one of them. And so being anti-racist is just one of the ways that we can help to battle white supremacy. And being anti-racist simply means being actively working against the system of that privileges racism. So that doesn't mean saying that you're colorblind. It doesn't mean, you know, a lot of the things that people do that kind of dance around the issue. It means that you are taking action each and every day to make sure that you are operating in a way that dismantles that part of the system.
Yeah, and there's this poem in there from Nayira Wahid. Never trust anyone who says they do not see color. This means to them, you are invisible. And throughout the book, you emphasize the importance of recognizing and accepting our differences, not just race, but a number of things. If somebody is disabled or a different religion, a different sexual orientation, and not overlooking and homogenizing them, which is a tendency in the U.S. And you have another quote from Pastor Michael McBride: liberation is where a difference is seen as an asset and not a liability. Why is that a more effective way and probably a necessary way to combat racism rather than just this common practice of saying, hey, I don't see color, we're all the same here in the U.S.?
Well, because ultimately, you know, and the quote that you read previously really gets at it. At the point that you say that you don't see color, that you are colorblind, what you're ultimately saying is that you don't see me. And it's impossible for you to dismantle a system that you can't even acknowledge exists. And how can you help people when you can't acknowledge that you can see them? You know, people ask me all the time, you know, what is it that they think that they should do? And I think, you know, I start there. Like, don't call yourself colorblind. You should be working toward being anti-racist. Another thing is, you know, I tell folks not to ask Black and other people of color to do emotional or other labor for them. A lot of, you know, what it means to be anti-racist is to do research and find out information for yourself and to not expect other people to do the work for you, which very often is labor that is placed upon the backs of Black folks. Also, it's important to be courageous and hold yourself and the white people around you to be accountable for the ways that they're holding up the system of white supremacy.
That's actually a lot of good advice, but the book itself is kind of more educational and inspirational than prescriptive. And I have a quote in your previous book, How We Fight White Supremacy. You took a similar tack. And in your introduction to that book, you wrote, although this book is not prescriptive, if we had a magic button we could press to end this nightmare, we would have leaned on it long ago. And I used it instead of some words.
Yeah. I was wondering what you're going to do there.
I know. Well, instead of the beep, I thought I would just kind of reword just slightly. Mm-hmm. And the book, you called it as thoughtful and hopeful and bursting with agency. I would say the same thing about anti-racism. So that's very much by design, not taking that prescriptive approach.
Absolutely. You know, I think this book really functions in a couple of ways. One, I think it's an entry or 101 to the concept of anti-racism that we've been talking about. And then I also think it works really well as a resource. You know, my daughter was recently studying her line. She's doing this virtual play at school because we're, you know, still doing remote learning. And Cesar Chavez was one of the leads in the play. And she came to me and she asked me a bit about him. And I was really excited that I could pick up the book and flip to the page with his, you know, words and his photo, and then also read the short bio that I wrote about him. And that's really how I hope that it functions for a lot of people. You know, I hope that folks can use it as a resource, but also move beyond that, and in reading it, either see themselves on the page as they currently are, or see the person that they want to be, and that it helps them find their own ways to be actively anti-racist every single day.
We mentioned in the intro, too, that you'll be moderating a session called No Justice, No Peace at the Portland Book Festival. This year, the festival is entirely online and to take place over 2 weeks instead of one big day, as it has previously because of the pandemic. The session you'll be moderating features two young adult novelists, Kim Johnson and Francisco X. Stork, and that will be live streamed this Saturday, the 14th. Can you give us a little preview of the session, how it came together, and tell us a little bit about Kim and Francisco?
Well, sure. It came together really because my publisher, Sashquass Books, is based in the Northeast, and Northwest.
Yes, Seattle.
And, they're in Seattle. And, you know, they like to always send authors, and we felt that this was a wonderful time to really lift up, you know, not only the work that's in anti-racism, but other YA works. And I was just really pleased to be put together with Kim and Francisco to be able to do this this panel. I haven't had the pleasure of meeting them yet, and I'm very excited to, but I have been reading their books and am really looking forward to talking to them about the themes that really cross all three books, which, you know, focus on the issues of racial justice and immigration and the ways that those things intersect.
I wish we could speak more. I've got so many questions here. But the last one is, where can listeners find out more about anti-racism, your newest book, and all your work and upcoming events?
Sure. So online, I'm at kenria.com, which is kenrya.com. And since my parents are so creative and gave me a name that no one else really has, I'm at Kenria on all the social media. So on Twitter and on IG, I am there heavy. So I'd love to see you all there.
We've been talking with Kenria Rankin, author of the new book, Anti-Racism, Powerful Voices, Inspiring Ideas from Seattle Sasquatch Books. Kenria will be moderating a Portland Book Festival panel, No Justice, No Peace, featuring young adult novelists Kim Johnson and Francisco X. Stork. The event will be live-streamed this Saturday, November 14th at 2:30 p.m. Pacific Time. You can find out more online at pdxbookfest.org, and you can find out more about anti-racism, Kenria's new book, and all her work online at kenria.com. This is Ken Jones for KBOOS News In Depth.